The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Hope fills the air. Markets continue to like what they hear. We have a holiday shortened week for markets, and we're going to talk about the rise of the cult of the FinPro. All this and much more on episode 600 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, good day to you. Hope you're having a wonderful week, a wonderful weekend. A little bit of a longer week here. We have the celebration and the overall observance of President's Day. You have a day off on Monday. Many people do, not everybody. As a matter of fact, a lot of people that I've talked to don't have the day off, which is interesting because it is a federal holiday. Anyway, this is Andrew Horowitz, and I am the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm also the host of DH Unplugged, co-host with John C. Dvorak, which you can listen to our discussions and rants and our attempt at some comedy there over on dhunplugged.com or any place that you can find podcasts. As a matter of fact, starting just this week, you can find both the Disciplined Investor Podcast as well as DH Unplugged over on Spotify. So if you've been waiting for that and hoping for that, there you go. We're on Spotify. So let's talk about this. It is episode 600. And I wonder how many of you have been here since the beginning. I got to tell you, you may think, well, oh boy, I've started maybe a year ago or some people 2 years ago. I still get a lot of emails from people that tell me they've been here since episode number one. And that was back in like 2007 when we're first starting out. And I sometimes go back and I listen to that and I listen to how my voice sounded with the current equipment that I had at the time. And how we've evolved the podcast from a quality perspective in terms of just the equipment and the output and also the guests that we have and the topics that we talk about and the content overall. It's been quite a journey and I'm really proud of that. If you haven't had the opportunity, I was also on Frank Curzio's podcast last week. So you can listen to Wall Street Unplugged and find out what I was talking about there. So a couple of things before we start the guts of today's show, because I am a little bit steamed. My blood is boiling a little bit, and I want to talk to you about this. But before we get to that, let's talk about the markets for a second, because we had a big week for markets. The S&P was up like 2.5%. The Dow Jones closed up just about 3% higher on the 5 days. NASDAQ lagged a little bit. It was only up 2% for the week. Small caps rallied hard. They were up more than about 4%. And all of them, when you look at a chart, are really getting close to key resistance levels from the breakdown that we saw in October. So if you look back to the October timeframe and you kind of move across and you see where we are now, there is a little bit of topping action, kind of some triple tops that we're seeing. And so there's a good level of volume at price, or price at volume, depending on how you want to look at it, resistance at these levels also. That V-shaped recovery that we saw recently has been pushing things into the, quote, overbought levels. And you know my thinking about this, if you've been listening to me for any time, you know that, well, overbought, oversold, we could probably stay overbought for a lot longer than we can stay oversold. Oversold conditions resolve relatively quickly, as I see it, because when you look at history and you look at these oversold conditions that you base on things like possibly distance from the S&P distance from the 50-day moving average, 200-day moving average, you look at a standard deviation from those levels, or if you look at more traditional kind of the RSIs or MACDs, the McClellan, the Spearman, all of these resolve relatively quickly when it comes to the downside move when you're oversold significantly, especially when you're deeply in the oversold levels. Overbought levels, when you talk about that, you can hear people talk about that for a long period of time. And all the reasons we've talked about in the past really come into play here because people are much more accustomed to buying than selling. And when things are low, they think things are on sale, so they buy. And when things are going up, 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 really, they say, well, it's probably a lot more opportunity in the future. We're going to continue buying and getting on this train to the next level on the upside. So what you see is a significant amount of a quick and significant move off of the lows when you see those very severe oversold levels. Overbought can last for a while. My point here is that while we talk about this overbought condition, realize that it may last a while. At the same time, I want you to look at some of these other things that we see in the charts. Again, one of the really interesting things is we are seeing a broadening of the rally, a broadening out, more stocks participating in this. We see that the new highs are starting to lift off of the bottoms. But one of the other things that I've been noticing is that this broadening out is also taking stocks very severely above their moving average. Now, again, you know my discussion about moving averages. I'm not really a big fan of using them on an individual basis necessarily. But when I start to see a culmination of information that comes in, and I look at things like the percent of S&P stocks above or below their 50-day moving average, I take notice. For example, if you take a look back in, let's call it the lows in December, you know, where the market was selling off for the October, November, December period and culminated in that gigantic flush lower on Christmas Eve. At that time, only 1% of the S&P stocks was above its 50-day moving average. So it's an interesting sign because when there's a great deal of movement that's against the longer-term moving averages and we see that there is a significant amount of distance being formed above or below, it should tell you something very interesting. And markets usually have a reversion type of process that goes on when you get far away from the longer-term averages. But where are we now? So if we were 1% in December, only 1% of the stocks in the S&P 500 was above its longer-term 50-day moving average. And we could talk about 100 and 200s also, but I'm really focusing on this 50-day because that is, it's a long-term average. I mean, 50 trading days. But when we look at it now, 91% of stocks are above that. We haven't seen that since April of 2016. And what happened then? Well, in April 16, we saw that there was a big move to the upside over time. We saw this nice rally that broadened out, just like we're seeing now, although it wasn't as steep and the slope wasn't as vertically oriented that we are seeing today. But nonetheless, we had this move that moved up. And after that, when we got to this level of about 92 back then, 91, 92, of the S&P 500 stocks that were above their 50-day moving average, markets consolidated for a while and then regained on their uptrend. So we saw some consolidation. Things kind of got very hot and there was a realization things maybe got a little bit on the upside, you know, quote, overbought. Maybe there was too much of a push for some reason. And then things cooled off for a while and then slowly regained that upward trajectory, slow and steady for a while. What I'm looking at now is a different kind of market because the move on the level of price appreciation, the vertical move comparatively, reminds me of the characteristics that we saw in the market in the time period of about October 2017 to February 2018. There was a big rally, a big run. We got very overbought. We saw a significant amount of stocks above the 50-day moving average. A major majority of them were over their 50-day moving average. And also we saw a lot of the indicators that looked very similar. We saw this V, or at least a very sharp vertical move up. It was a little bit of a longer time period. We're talking about that was October through February. Here we're talking about the vertical nature being January and February. So you have almost 2.5 months less and the same vertical move that we saw. And what happened after that? Well, the big rally became overbought. We saw a sharp and quick correction. And the one thing that I'm looking at right now is Friday's, last Friday's gap and run that we saw for the major markets that we opened up higher and just ran higher on the news that there was going to be, you know, the government shutdown is not going to happen and there's possibly some movement in the China talks. So there may be some possible topping action that coincides with some of the things that we've seen before, like the percent of stocks above the 50-day moving average, the fact that we are also seeing that there's a couple of overbought indicators that are flashing. And on top of that, we're seeing a triple top across for major indices. It's close. It's not there. It's a little bit further up. And then we hit those triple tops. A great deal of what's going to happen from here, it looks like, kind of relies on the usual suspects. So from here, what we're going to have to continue seeing is the rhetoric about the China deal going through and the potential for the Fed maintaining a very dovish stance. And over the next couple of weeks, you are going to be just getting punched in the face with all sorts of information on every side of the equation until they figure out what works best for markets regarding what's going to happen with the March 1st deadline for the China trade talks. Because remember, after that, they're supposed to increase a tranche of about $200 billion, I think it is, from 10% to 25%. If there is no resolution that is agreeable by both sides. So there's going to be probably some more discussion that there'll be meetings, that the trade talks are going really well. And then my interpretation is they're probably going to see what happens if they don't finish it off. They delay the increase of the tariff increase and see how markets react to that. Then come in right after that with some kind of nonsense that they made a deal, they cut a deal with a couple things that are in there that are good and a few things that probably are the same. That's my bet on this whole thing. Markets just want some kind of resolution. Markets want to be beyond this. They want to be done with this whole thing because it's just an impediment to earnings. It's a problem for companies that can't properly plan. The outlook is constrained. And of course, prices are increasing. So here we are, right where I thought we would start to see some of the economic numbers rolling over. Remember, I talked about that last year. At the end of the year, they said, you know what, kind of January, February, we're going to start to see some of these numbers rolling. If we did, in fact, have the pull forward effect that provided for a front loading of manufacturing, of buying, of factory orders, of all sorts of conditions that were consistent with what we saw with the Japan retail sales tax increase back in 2014, 2015, we should start seeing about now some of that rolling process. And already we've seen that factory orders have slowed. Did you see the retail sales number last week? Retail sales fell by about almost 2%, the worst in decades. December was horrible. This is, by the way, on the heels of the National Retail Federation and all these different groups coming out and saying, what a fabulous month we had in December. Meanwhile, we're seeing terrible numbers for the core and heart of the holiday season. Now, maybe some of that had to do with the markets, people's confidence, consumers' confidence is kind of holding right now, but it did come down significantly from the levels that we saw, which were very elevated. But there is some inconsistency, to say the least, with what we heard from Retail Sales Federation and the various retail sales groups to what the actual number came out to be. And that's why we're seeing a significant rollover of many of the retail names. So right now, I think that what we're looking at is the start of what we had anticipated and what markets were anticipating, but didn't really happen right away with the earnings slowdown and now an economic slowdown on the back, and why the Fed, this all makes sense. Why the Fed has turned dovish just in a matter of 30 to 60 days compared to where they were November, mid-December, where the Fed is now and what they're trying to feed the market and they're trying to stimulate the idea that they're going to be much more market friendly and much more data dependent. This is all into the plan and plays out really well with the concept that the harm that was done is going to start spilling over and feel the impact in the economy and in earnings throughout 2019 into 2020. So where you saw that many analysts back in, we'll say November, December, were calling for a recessionary environment somewhere in the back end of 2019, but more so in 2020, I think they were looking at all these different things. And what we're seeing now is this reflexive trade on the hopes that the Fed will continue on, not thinking about, well, we're not going to see, you know, not thinking about any further revisions to the downside of earnings and no further degradation of the economic backdrop for the U.S. And realize one of the other things that we're seeing is that in Europe, nothing is getting better. In fact, last week, the EU is talking about considering another round of quantitative easing the way they do it there, LTROs. But basically what they're going to be doing is another round of bond buying. Now, you don't see that in an environment that is very healthy. So they took their bond buying offline for a little while. They considered increasing rates and talked about it. And before they even could get to that point, they're already back to potentially buying bonds once again. That dropped the euro, sent the dollar up a little bit. And, you know, of course, European markets applauded that. So did the U.S. markets. And I think some of the markets up that we saw at the end of the week was not only on the hope that we're seeing, getting towards an end to some of the headline risk with regard to the government shutdown as well as the China trade talks. But I think the idea that the European, you know, the ECB would be coming out with more stimulus really helped the market ease their concern about liquidity issues. This week coming up, we have a shortened week, as I mentioned. We have Fed minutes that will be reflecting on last month's Fed meeting and durable goods orders as well. So not much really happening on the economic frontier. But I would take a look, if you haven't had the opportunity, to look at the last week's numbers. In particular, PPI was a little bit, it was in line, but the headline number was a little bit hot. I would look at this whole notion of what's happening in the factory area and retail sales as a bit of a wake-up call to realize that markets are possibly pricing in a best-case scenario right now, when in fact we may just be at the beginning, at the forefront of this economic rollover. And if you consider how much consumer confidence has dropped overall, and the outward expectation has dropped, and housing prices have stabilized, and what we're seeing with the home builders, et cetera, when you look at this and you add it all up, it seems like it's inevitable that the market is pricing in really only the best that can happen and not taking into consideration some of the reality that we're seeing and that may be forthcoming in the economics. Something that we've actually modeled our portfolios on because we feel that there is upside opportunity, but the question has to be, well, how much? How much are you willing to risk right now getting into a very, very, we'll say, long in the tooth economic expansion when we know that markets and the economic cycle, everything cycles. There is no break in the cycle. There's only elongations and depth questions. How long is it going to last and how deep is it going to be? To the upside or downside and the length of time. So let's not get cute here and think that the Fed has it all under control, and there is not going to be the economic cycle, the peak to trough and all the stuff we learned in Econ 101. Let's not think that that's dead. Let's remember that it changes. It's dynamic. Something that you really need to make sure of that you hold on to when you're considering all the different options you have for investing. I just think it's something that you need to wake up to and think about and then kind of put everything else into perspective in terms of how you're positioning yourself moving forward. Now, on to the topic that I wanted to discuss. Why I mentioned on Twitter my blood was boiling, why I'm starting to get a shiver down the back of my neck, and why my hair was standing up a little bit. This may seem a little bit kind of crazy, but something really bothered me. And I want to start with the discussion and take you through this because I just think that there's something going on in the background that's concerning me. Let me give you this definition. And you probably know what I'm talking about here, but I'm not going to name it. So the definition is people that try too hard to be different and genuinely do think that they're being different by rejecting anything they deem to be too popular. And ironically, so many other people also try too hard to be different that they all wind up being exactly the same. So they aren't actually different at all, and they're just people that are snobbier and more annoying about their taste in alternative things, which are all popular now thanks to their beliefs. This is from the Urban Dictionary. I'm going to continue on. This group prides themselves on liking things that no one else likes and normally only really like them because they think no one else likes them and because they're being unique. This is being delusional because all other people in this think that the group also likes the same thing. Now, this is a definition from the Urban Dictionary, and it's clearly the definition from the Urban Dictionary of a hipster. But I want to take you and keep that in the background, but take you a little further. And I think this is also very much involved in the financial services area, financial pressure for professionals that fit this definition as well. And I'm not talking about as related to the age of the individual involved here. I'm talking about the concept of what they think they're doing. So when we plug in the word hipster here, let's plug in the word financial pro or fin pro. Think of this like the cult of the fin pro. They talk about the only way to invest is this. They talk about the only way to work with a client is that. They try to be different, but at the same time, it's all the same. It's recycled nonsense the way I see it. And it's ultimately their way of trying to make like they found something that is the absolute truth and the absolute answer and the holy grail of investing in client relations and financial planning. You find this group all over Twitter. I mean, they're everywhere. Social media, they love it. They get their presence out there. They espouse all sorts of interesting points, at least that they think is interesting. They think are interesting. So we have some examples of this that we've seen, right? So you have the whole idea of low-cost investing is the only way. Or another example, I guess, would be, factor investing is a new index investing. It's the only way to invest. Or the idea of set it and forget it is the only way and beats out trading. And you want to use just the only index investing. Yeah, there is some logic and some truth to their religion, I'll tell you right now. But the problem is, it's not a one-size-fits-all world. And their idea of getting so dramatic, they're dramatic. They're drama kings and queens, I must tell you. They're drama about how you only want to do this and they found this is the only way is repulsive, frankly. I see it all the time. Here's the fact. People are different. individual investors are as different as there are people. Different risk tolerance levels and different time horizons, different goals. Doesn't that have to be taken into consideration when you invest? When you put together a plan, when you put together a overall portfolio allocation? And you may be asking yourself at this point, Andrew, what the hell are you talking about? I mean, why are you talking about this? What's the problem? Where's this all coming from? Now, I'll tell you where it's coming from is that there was a tweet this week that somehow, I don't know, somehow managed to get its way on my timeline. And I don't follow this gent, but somehow I got this on my timeline and it just really bugged me. And I'm not really talking about the gent who put it there, but I'm talking about the concept. So I'm not really thrashing on him, although you make a ticket that way. So if you're listening, sir, I apologize in advance for knocking you real hard here. And I'm talking about, you may be a really nice guy. You may be just some great work, but this thing that you talked about really bugged me. And he said, I'm not going to name names. He's a financial advisor. He works with investments and insurance products. I looked him up. He does a bunch of work with a wirehouse or a broker dealer and sells insurance and all that stuff. But here's what he said that really got under my skin. And then we'll go through it because you probably still think I'm a lunatic. He said, or he tweeted, people ask me what I do for a living all the time. I came up with a new answer. I help people watch paint dry for about 30 years while stopping them from acting on their worst impulses during all the bull and bear markets that they're going to live through. Now, first of all, I heard this 100 times. It's not unique to this gent who posted that. It may be somebody else's. I think he may have even stole this from somebody else or brought this over from somebody else or quoted somebody else. It's not so much that. It's not all this. It's not, again, it's not. They may do great jobs for their clients. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the concept of these catchy phrases that are being used by this cult or those that want to be in the cult or break into the idea of, I want to be just like them. I don't know. Just gets my blood a little bit frothy. The question is that what you as an investor or anyone is paying someone to do for them as their advisor? And yes, it's part of the let's get something clear. It is part of the process as a financial advisor to be trusted and well-reasoned and a professional to assist clients through all sorts of market cycles, right? I think we all agree with that. There is some psychology at work here where you need to be a partner with your client through a variety of market problems, cycles. Obviously, people are, you know, there's just as much harm in someone who decides at a really bad time that they want to just blow out everything that they have, whether they do that on their own or they do that individually with their advisor or without. But at the same time, they also have a problem when they get too enamored and too excited and they get that FOMO going at the tops and peaks of markets. So there is some hand-holding that goes on and there is some a sense of reason and a cooler, rational head that is not necessarily emotionally attached to your money that you can then bounce ideas off of and talk with and all that. But do you pay somebody to do that? And what is this worth on its own? I mean, could you really just do that on your own? Just decide that you're going to do something and just put it away? Because we know it. Listen, it's hard to do on your own. And I get what the fact is by using a professional in this regard as a professional paint watcher can give you some sense of comfort. It could, listen, we know that emotions and emotions could provide a very an environment for a very bad decision-making process during market swings. So if you have somebody that's helping you watch the paint, that's good. But But personal beliefs, we know, and personal stress and political leanings and social media, news headlines can impact all of our views as investors and may influence our market outlook in a pretty destructive manner. So I get that. So again, there is something to be said for having a market psychologist on the payroll that can help one through all this. But at the same time, and here's what I want to get to, because it makes it look like this whole line about watching paint dry for 30 years that you just invest in, you just leave it alone forever. Now, that may be good if you pick the right things and they pick the right stocks, and maybe if you're even so much so well diversified that it doesn't even matter. But what this is inferring in a way is that portfolios or financial plans are static. Like paint drying, you throw it on a wall and you just watch it dry. And then eventually it's, or look at it as it's ripe for picking eventually. Suggesting that what really burns me, suggesting that watching paint dry is anyway the same as financial investment planning. And of course it was a use of a way to see it a different way. But in my opinion, it's a terrible disservice for investors, for individuals that are trying to create a solid and sound financial plan and investment portfolio over time. The whole process is much more dynamic. And anyone that tells you that it's not is clearly not really thinking about all the variables that go into a long-term plan, a long-term process, and all the different things that go into making for a market. Of course, on the opposite side, we have advisors that probably make adjustments just for the sake of making adjustments. That's not good either, probably. So somewhere in between all this, where you have an advisor who's just watching paint dry, and on the other side, where you have advisors that are painting and recoloring and recoding and wallpapering just because they want to change it on a regular basis, probably is expending too much energy for no good reason. So somewhere in between there is some opportunity, I think, to consider what may be the right fit. Because sometimes there are radical changes that should be made to a portfolio that are dependent on a client's risk tolerance or financial situation. You know, you can't tell me that if markets are dropping dramatically and people have a certain amount of risk that they're willing to put forth involved in this whole process, that if they don't want to stay in with it and they want to get out, it's the wrong thing to do. I mean, yes, it may not be the right thing to do if all their risk tolerance and time horizon and goals are lined up and that's what is right, panicking and selling isn't the right thing either. So yes, of course, it makes sense to talk through what is the risk that you want to, that's most appropriate for your portfolio, Mr. Client? And where are we going with this and what's the goal? We know we're going to see volatility. If in fact, you get to a situation where the risk in the portfolio is too great and the movement of the portfolio has dug into a point that a client would want to maybe get out, or an investor says, I've had enough, maybe the design wasn't right to begin with. Now, how is that? So just because you threw some paint on a wall doesn't mean that that paint is going to be the color of preference for your lifetime. Here's something to think about. While this whole process is all about making money and growing the portfolio, at the same time, it's not all about making money and growing the portfolio. If it was, it'd be pretty easy. Just dump it in a couple of stocks and just let it go forever and hope for the best. Fingers crossed, legs crossed, I'm in good shape. Let it just go, let it ride. But that's not how it works. So when we talk about this whole cult and this whole thing they talk about on a regular basis, the one thing that I keep thinking about is when they were all screaming about how index, low-cost index fund investing is the only way to go. You know, we debunked this idea several months ago when we looked at the low-cost index investing And the whole thought that, oh, it's great for every sector and every asset class is the only way you want to go. Low cost, low cost, low cost. Forget about everything else. You want low cost. You remember this? We put a whole paper up on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I went through this and I debunked the idea. Now, how many of them that I sent it to actually commented back? Only a couple. Because it goes against their very notion of what they believe as a group, regardless of the facts presented. So when you look at this and you look at the whole idea of paint drying versus dynamic. Now again, not dynamic to be dynamic. It's not the whole idea of making changes for the point of making changes. It's all about where things lie. Listen, look back to the 1990s. Back in the late 1990s, value and growth were in and out of favor. Now, if you're too young or don't even remember this, let me tell you, it was a major differential between value and growth and then turn to growth and value. As a matter of fact, I remember very clearly a lot of people were asking me about, hey, I got this this institutional manager that we're investing in. They're doing great for the last 5 years. Things have been unbelievable. I'm not going to mention names. They were a value investor, hardcore, absolute, buy the book, value investor, looking for stocks that were, quote, cheap, higher dividends, higher quality, maybe low price to equity, low price to book, all this stuff that would at that time signify a value stock. And they did really well. And what happened was that while value was doing well, growth was doing very poorly. Into the late 1990s, growth was just horrible. Tech wasn't doing well. Healthcare was, you know, all the growth orientation was just getting killed. So what did everybody do? Somewhere along the line, they realized, oh, you know what? Maybe I shouldn't be in this growth orientation either. And what I want to do is I want to go after that value because all my friends are doing really well and everybody I listen to is doing really well. This is before social media. So you know what? I'm switching. And lo and behold, what happened? There was a major reversal. Value became out of favor into the end of 1990. If you remember the 1990s, 1999 and 2000, growth was really in favor. Value plummeted. So they went out of the growth and into value just at the wrong time. And I remember this clearly because these shops, these value and growth shops were just killing it on either side. And it seems that investors never caught it quite right. Of course, the story concludes with the fact that they went into value and then they decided to go back to growth because growth was now picking up. And then they got obliterated in the early 2000s. And that's the true story. I saw it with my own eyes. I watched these people go from, I remember the name of the firms, I'm not going to mention them, but major institutional firms and private client type of management. They went into one, they got killed, they went to the other, they got killed, they decided to flip back, and then they got killed. So the point is that things are not as simple as trying to say that this has worked for the last however many years and it's going to last forever like this. Diversification is a very important part of the overall process. Now, we have a couple of different portfolios that are diversified. One that is one strategy that's not, but it's meant to be a diversifier. That other, the long short strategy with the TDI managed growth is supposed to be a long short diversifier. But in our global growth, you know, here's how I see it. In our global allocations, I should say. I see balancing, tilting sectors and allocations, refinement of a portfolio over time. That doesn't mean watching paint dry. Sometimes it's a tweak. Sometimes it's a major change. Not this whole idea of set it and forget it, paint drying or FOMO chasing, right? That's the other thing we see. This is what investors, I think, should look for an advisor, someone who will, yes, hold their hand through different times, but in a way, not just to hold their hand, to hold their hand. Not just to sit back and say, listen, I don't want to be bothered by any changes. You know, long term, it's always going to be good. Just stay in an S&P 500 fund. You'll be fine all forever time. My advice is to avoid those that are trying to be different for the sake of being different. Markets cycle, and so do these ideologies, by the way. But what's worked may change, but let's not get into the whole debate of this time is different. All of a sudden, this time, it's just all about index investing or paint drying or it cycles. Bottom line is do your homework. You know that. Be smart. You got to work with somebody who could give you the flexibility that is appropriate in various market conditions, but also a dose of reality and, yes, some hand-holding at the same time. Bottom line, don't be indoctrinated by the cult of the FinPro. I mean, that, because they will, it's almost like it's like a brainwashing. I try to look at their stuff objectively because they just come through my various social media, but then I realize, oh man, this is all about social media, isn't it? All about trying to get people to believe in the fact that Pabst Blue Ribbon is actually a good beer to drink. I mean, when PBR, when I drank that as a kid or as a young person, the only reason we did is because it was cheap, but it was terrible. But now some people believe it's really a cool thing to drink. Go figure. Don't get caught up in that. Don't get caught up in, you know, just doing what everybody does. Do what's right for you. Do what's appropriate for you. Do what is that makes sense for you, and work with somebody that's not stuck in one idea or another, that can be flexible enough to work with you in your current and future situation. Am I happy I got that off my chest? A little bit. But I was really, when I first saw it a couple days ago, I was really miffed. So I may have calmed down a little bit here. And so just thought it was interesting. If you have any comments on that, if you want to tell me I'm full of crap or, you know, agree with me or tell me your thoughts on this, write in over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Go over to the Ask Andrew section. You can always write me any comments or concerns or questions or ideas that you have for other guests that maybe you want to have on the show. So you can do that all the time over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check that out. We're going to end the show early. We have a short week. We're going to have a short show. So hope you enjoyed this and you got something out of it. Something, hopefully. That's the whole goal here, to get a little bit of education, cover the markets, cover investing, financial planning, all that good stuff. With that in mind, I will see you again next Sunday. And before that, of course, Tuesday night with John C. Dvorak on DH Unplugged. Go check out all the times, the chat room and all that over on dhunplugged.com. I'll see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.